Good afternoon. I'm Allison Ruttenberg for the appellant, and I was appointed by the ADC to represent Mr. Trujillo. This is kind of an unusual case. There was lots of unusual things that happened pre-trial in this case after the robbery at the P.F. Chang's in December 2003. There were four defendants identified. Only one of them was picked up right away. And she was picked up within weeks of the robbery, and she gave a taped interview where the DA was present, and she identified the other three men. However, my client, Mr. Trujillo, was not even charged for another 13 months. The other defendants were charged and arrested and arraigned before my client was even charged. So during that 1 year delay, a bunch of things happened. Mr. Hopker was arraigned, then two of the co-defendants pled guilty, and then my client was arrested. And my client's case was joined with Mr. Hopker's case over my client's objection. I am not appealing the court's ruling of that initial decision to join. What I'm appealing a much more narrow issue. What I'm saying is, after Mr. Hopker's counsel then asked for another delay on the eve of trial in 2007, it was error for the judge to not sever the two cases at that point, because that would have violated my client's speedy trial rights. So to just go back to the facts for a second, after the cases were joined, then a bunch of other unusual things happened. The case went up to the Supreme Court on a Rule 21 petition, and the case was stayed for over a year. And nobody, including me, is contending that any of that time that the case was stayed violates a defendant's speedy trial rights under the speedy
trial. You're talking strictly about the statutory speedy trial,
yes.
Right?
Okay. Yes. Unfortunately, during that time that the case was stayed by the Colorado Supreme Court, the police department destroyed all the forensic evidence from the robbery. Just an unfortunate miscommunication between the police and the DA. They often do that once a case closes. They saw that two people had pled guilty, they thought the case was closed, and they destroyed all the evidence. Then Supreme Court mandate issues, the case is back on track, there's a couple months left on the speedy trial clock. Trial is set for January 29th, 2007, which is well within speedy, but 2 weeks before that, Mr. Hopker's counsel asked for a continuance because he has a personal family emergency. And the court grants Mr. Hopker's counsel that continuance. But then my client objects and says, I do not waive my speedy trial rights, and I assert my right to be tried before the speedy trial date of March 15th, 2007. And the DA at that point made a very short argument without making much of a record that, well, the witnesses only want to have to testify twice, and there'll be some expense involved in having two separate trials. Therefore, District Court, pursuant to 18-14056C, you can overrule Mr. Trujillo's objection. The DA did not make a record as to exactly what the witnesses were feeling, how expensive it would be, how inconvenient it would be. And she also never made a record as to why she waited for close to 14 months to even charge my client to begin with after Mr. Hopker had been arrested. If she was really serious about this issue, both of these defendants had to be tried together because it would be unfair to the witnesses to make them testify twice, then she should have made more of an effort in 2004 to actually bring them to court at close to the same time. But she waited for over 14 months, and she never made a record as to what that delay was for. So Mr. Trujillo's argument is that the district court erred and violated CRS 18-14056C. This statute provides that the court may grant a reasonable period of delay beyond speedy trial when that, first of all, has to be reasonable. Second of all, when the defendant is joined for trial with a co-defendant for whom the time has not run. And at that point, Mr. Hopker's time had not run because his motion for a continuance had been granted. And this is the key, there is good cause for not granting a severance. Now, in People versus...
Ms. Ruttenberg, what is the standard for us to review the determination whether to grant a severance? Isn't it abuse of discretion?
My position was, and I believe I argued for Genovo, because the court misapplied the statute altogether.
But is the argument that the... As I understand your contention is that there was a violation of speedy trial, and that it would, the severance, the denial of the severance violated speedy trial. So, I mean, I think Judge Jones's question is a good one. Normally, if all you were dealing with is a question about whether the denial of the motion for severance was error, I think that's abuse of discretion. But here you've tied it with speedy trial, which is your real concern, as I understand it. So what is the standard of review?
Right, and that's why I argued for a de novo standard of review. You have to defer to the district court's findings of facts upon which you made that ruling. But the appellate courts apply a de novo standard of review to ascertain whether the trial court's legal conclusions, in other words, whether those facts were sufficient under that statutory definition of when a reasonable time can be granted beyond speedy trial over Mr. Trujillo's objection, that is de novo.
I thought your argument wasn't to the time after speedy trial. I mean, the continuance here was a couple of months. I thought your argument was that the severance should have been granted.
Not way back in 2005. What I'm saying is, once the court granted Mr. Hopker's motion for continuance in January of 2007, and Mr. Trujillo objected to that continuance because that took him beyond the speedy trial date, then the court had to sever the two cases, and the court's failure to sever those two cases was not authorized under 18.1405(6)(c).
Right, but the statute doesn't say that in those circumstances a court has to, as you put it, grant a severance. The court says unless there's good cause, and that seems to me to be a discretionary call at the trial court.
Well, I'm arguing that there are insufficient facts in the record for him to have made that conclusion, and therefore the court can.
Does not the statute appear to shift the burden to the prosecution?
Well, that was
doesn't the statute sort of presume there'll be a severance, unless the prosecution can show good cause why there shouldn't be?
Right, that was going to be my next argument, that 6C is an exception that the DA is trying to apply, and therefore it was the DA who had the burden of proof to show that there was good cause for not granting a severance. It wasn't Mr. Trujillo's burden to show that there was not good cause for not granting a severance.
And did the DA in this case make a showing?
The DA did not make a sufficient enough showing.
Well, you say not sufficient. What showing did he or she make, if any?
She just made two general statements. She said it would be unfair to the witnesses to testify twice, and there would be some expense involved in holding two trials. Now, if that's all it
did, in other words, he didn't suggest there would be any prejudice to his or her case.
That was all she could articulate for the prejudice, was that there would be some expense involved, and it would be unfair to the witnesses to have to testify twice.
Didn't the judge also have in front of it, it may have been the same judge, I can't remember that, I don't think so, the prior judge's rulings on the joinder to begin with, and what, why that was a proper thing to do?
My position is that the reasons for the joinder in the first place are irrelevant to the speedy trial issue. Nobody is disputing that Mr. Trujillo did not have a right to a severance under the evidentiary rules, that the initial severance was proper. I am not appealing that issue.
Initial joinder?
Yes. So the judge's ruling that the joinder was proper and Mr. Trujillo had no right to a severance as of right is not relevant. And if the General Assembly meant for that same standard to apply to the speedy trial statute, that's what it would have said. It would have said that a reasonable period of delay when a defendant is joined for trial with a co-defendant for which he has no right to a severance as a matter of right, instead of and there is good cause for not granting a severance.
Well, it may not be the same standard, but why wouldn't some of those factors be relevant to the judge's decision on whether there was good cause or not to grant the severance?
Well, from looking at the case law, and there's only three cases, the case law has to go more to the prejudice of the prosecution, the time and expense of trying to marshal the witnesses and the evidence to hold two trials. And that's the type of showing that has to be made to overcome the denial of the defendant's speedy trial right, not whether the defendant had the right to or had an evidentiary right to a severance as a matter of right, because his rights to self-incrimination or some other right would be violated if all this other testimony came in pursuant to the co-defendant. So I believe those are two completely separate and distinct legal issues. If there are no other questions right now, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for a rebuttal.
Fine, you have 4 minutes. I assume you want to stand on your briefs on the remaining issues?
Yes.
May it please the court, Paul Kaler. I'm a first assistant attorney general, 19210. I have to start with my telegraph version of our argument. First of all, there was no statutory speedy trial violation. 18-1405-6C allows for a tolling of the period during the time when a co-defendant is unavailable. I guess sounds like the court's main concern is whether what degree of good cause showing needs to be made.
Well, I'm reading the statute as saying he's entitled to a severance when that occurs to protect his speedy trial right, and it's up to the prosecution to have good cause why that should not be granted. Do you read the statute the same?
I think you're presenting it a little bit more forcefully than the statute does, Your Honor. It just says the time is told during this period. During a reasonable period for when it doesn't say anything that a severance is required or anything like that. I don't.
Well, let me find the actual text. A reasonable period of delay when the defendant is joined for trial with a co-defendant as to whom the time for trial is not run, and there is good cause for not granting a severance.
Right.
Now, that phrase, good cause for not granting a severance, would seem to say, absent good cause, severance should be granted, right? And it's obviously the prosecution's obligation to come up with good cause.
Right. And I believe the prosecution did here, and the trial court did make the finding. I don't think there needs to be much of a finding in this particular case. As the U.S. Supreme Court said in Richardson versus Marsh, when two defendants have been accused of committing the same crime together and they've been properly joined for trial, there are strong reasons both as far as judicial economy and sort of fundamental fairness to make sure that the trials are run together, to make sure that the prosecution and
so you think the original considerations that gave rise to the joinder can also be used to argue against the severance and be good cause?
Well, they're strong considerations, Your Honor, and to support those, the prosecution said quite clearly that it would hurt the victims to have to show up again, and it would cost more money to retry the case again within a short period of time. That, I think that's all that needs to be done in this particular case.
That's true in every case.
I would think so, Your Honor.
Yeah, I mean, so basically, he's not entitled to a severance because the prosecution doesn't have to show much of anything.
Right. I think most of the time, I guess there could be some cases where the prosecution could not be harmed some strange cases, but most of the time where you're dealing with a case like this where you have a violent crime, multiple civilian witnesses are involved, there's expense involved too. The presumption of joint trials for defendants who commit crimes together is maintained. There doesn't need to be much of a showing. Constitutional speedy trial claim. Our argument is that by not presenting it down below, at least not in a developed fashion, the claim was waived. Also, concerning the last issue, the prejudice issue, the only claim of prejudice is the loss of these spent cartridges and the loss of the plastic pistol grip that had no apparent value, and any sort of harm derived from the loss of that evidence was entirely speculative.
Who fired a weapon during this?
I believe, well,
my understanding was the guard fired a weapon.
And I don't think it really matters all that much, Your Honor.
Bob, but so the rounds would not be traceable to any of the defendants because they didn't fire a weapon, as I understand.
Right, and I believe the crime lab evidence was that these cartridges were so small that fingerprints could not be pulled from them, and tool mark or the cartridges could not be analyzed to point to any particular firearm. So really, there was nothing involved in that. It's unfortunate that, you know, the long delay in getting this case to trial caused loss of that evidence, but it really didn't affect the result of the trial because there was no exculpatory value to it at all. I guess that's really all I have. No mandatory severance, obviously, because it was not a case where there was very damaging evidence concerning one defendant that did not apply to the other defendant, and the normal limiting instructions would not function. I'll talk real briefly about the other issues, the juvenile adjudications. Obviously, in our Segovia, the defendant's case, you can talk about the underlying circumstances that led up to different adjudications, and to show under 608B to show the character for truthfulness or untruthfulness. But that was not the way the claim was presented down below. The way it was presented down below was just the mere fact of the adjudications was enough to impeach, and that's just not improper.
So it's your position that the defense attorney could have said, witness, do you remember July 5th, 1986, and weren't you committing a burglary on that day?
Yes, Your Honor.
You could do that.
Right. That would be perfectly permissible. And this is not in our brief, but it was the same one thing that thought to me, since this particular witness was the one who, during her smoke breaks, would notice the armored car came up and she sort of set everything into motion, it might have been actually assisted her, the credibility of her testimony, by showing that she was a bad person. She was a person who'd been involved in robberies and larcenies. She was the type of person who would talk to people like the defendant in this particular case and set this crime, particular crime, in motion. So I think impeachment might have impeachment value one way, but it might have also bolstered her credibility going the other way. I've already talked about the destruction of the evidence. Unfortunate, it was negligent, no apparent exculpatory value at the time, and no prejudice to the defendant. I'll try and answer any of the questions the court might have. Otherwise, I think I'm done. Thank you, Your Honors.
For 3 minutes, 59 seconds.
It's my position that the Supreme Court case in Marsh is completely irrelevant to that case. That case is not construing the statute at issue here. That case is discussing whether severance in general is proper. And I'm saying that there are two different and distinct arguments here. It is not the case that just because severance was proper to begin with, that a defendant can never get a severance then under the speedy trial statute.
Counsel, let me explore that a little bit more, because I agree with you that they are separate issues, but why isn't it that some of the factors that are relevant to whether joinder is proper in the first place, same witnesses, trying to keep it all in one for efficiency purposes, cost, all those kinds of factors, why aren't those at least relevant to the issue of good cause, which I agree with you is a separate legal issue, but I don't understand why some of that evidence and some of those factors aren't relevant as to both legal tests.
Well, nobody is denying that there were going to be the same witnesses in both cases, except for the witnesses involving Mr. Hopker's stolen car, and that they were going to have to testify twice. So to the extent that was considered on the original motion to sever, then yes, those are some of the same factors that the DA brought up in regards to speedy trial. But the litigation around the original motion to sever was that Mr. Trujillo had a right to sever because all this evidence of Mr. Hopker's stolen cars were going to come in, and that was going to prejudice Mr. Trujillo. And that has nothing to do with the speedy trial analysis or nothing to do with how the court analyzed the speedy trial issue several years later. And then, you know, the Attorney General's position is that all you have to do is say, look, we'd have to call some of the same witnesses twice, and that'd be inconvenient, and it would cost some money, and then you never get a severance under CRS 18 1-405.
I think that's precisely what he said.
Yeah, exactly. And that just can't be right, because he's reading that exception then right out of the statute, because in every single case where you've got two co-defendants who committed a crime together who are joined from trial, you necessarily are going to have some of the same witnesses, if not all of the same witnesses. It's going to be inconvenient for them to testify twice. And it always costs more to have two trials rather than one trial. And if that's what the General Assembly wanted when they wrote the statute, then they would have denied a speedy trial in all situations where there were co-defendants and one of them had good cause for a continuance beyond speedy. But that's not the way the General Assembly wrote the statute.
But we don't have to go there, do we? I mean, don't we just have to look at this record and see what the arguments are and see how the court ruled and whether there's, on this record, there is a basis for how the court ruled?
And my argument is based on this record, the court didn't do anything more than what happened in People versus Hernandez, and the Court of Appeals found that that was insufficient record, and that therefore this case should be remanded and dismissed for violation of Mr. Trujillo's right to speedy trial.
In Hernandez, was there even a finding of good cause?
Well, the trial court failed to make any findings.
But here we do have findings.
Well, we have some very conclusory findings that aren't based on anything except just the DA kind of speculating some things off the top of her head. I still think there's insufficient findings. And if you look at the other two cases where a much better record was made, such as we have 180 witnesses, which is not true in this case. There's not 180 witnesses. There were about a dozen at the most. No findings for how expensive it was going to be to bring them back. Were there any out-of-state witnesses? No. There was no discussion, no findings made regarding that. There were no witnesses there's no finding that any witnesses would be traumatized by having to testify twice. Unlike Bacchus, this wasn't a delay of just a mere 2 weeks. This was a full 6 weeks, which is pretty significant under the speedy trial statute when you've got only 180 days to begin with. So again, Mr. Trujillo's position is that there were insufficient findings to justify any type of finding of good cause that would justify overruling Mr. Trujillo's
objection. There's nothing in the record that supports more than what the court found. And that is that it would be inconvenient and expensive.
Right. And it's always going to be more inconvenient to have two trials and more expensive. And therefore, if that's all that a court is required to say and all that a DA is required to say, you would have good cause every single time and you would read that clause right out of that statute, which is not what the General Assembly intended. Thank you.
Thank counsel for their briefs and arguments. The case will be deemed submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course.